Hi, everyone. Today is March 20th, 2014. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neurobiology Podcast. Our guest today is Massimo Scanciani, who is professor in the section of neurobiology at UCSD and an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Hi, Massimo.
Hi.
His research applies various methods to defining the core principles by which the elements of cortical architecture orchestrate cortical activity. Around the room, we've got Charlie Wilson.
Hello.
Hi, Charlie. We've got Alfonso Apicella.
Hello.
Hi, Alfonso. And we've got Todd Troyer.
Hello.
And me, I'm your host, Salma Qureshi. So, okay, let me just get started here. So I want to hit on a couple of different themes with you, all based on the idea of building generalizable principles of cortical circuit processing. The first is about thalamocortical and intracortical excitatory interactions in mouse V1 that you've spent a lot of time on, and how basically you found that, I guess what seemed like a relatively small amount of tuned thalamic inputs to layer 4, how they're conveyed and amplified intracortically. Could you say something about this and tie it into kind of the global picture of how and where primary sensory representations take shape, what we're kind of understanding about that recently? And then the next theme that we never get to the next one, but I'm hoping we get to it because it's really important. We've talked about it a lot here with other guests, is how likely it is that we'll ever be able to deliver sort of a standard functional connectivity map among cortical inhibitory interneurons. So rather than excitation, the inhibitory map that overlays on the canonical excitatory feed-forward cortical circuit. But first, I want to get to the cortical amplification story.
Like everyone, I'm fascinated by the cortex because we don't know what it does and we don't know how it does it, and yet we attribute to it every possible function, and it has a mystique at this point, right? And to some extent, I have to say, at least experimentally, the cortex has been quite disappointing in our hands. And it has been disappointing because it seems that what it does for the few experiments that we've performed is essentially only amplify a signal that comes already with its own shape in space and in time, and doesn't seem to add much more to it. So what I showed today is that the thalamus provides visual cortex with visual information, and that visual information already contains the seeds for the orientation tuning that the cortex is going to amplify. I haven't shown it today, but we have data also that suggests that the thalamus also provides information with regard to direction selectivity, not only orientation selectivity. And what the cortex does, it seems that it only amplifies that information rather than transforming it, right? And I've shown also today that even what we thought the cortex could do, which is somehow prolong the representation of a stimulus through its immense recurrence connectivity, seems not to be the case, at least for primary sensory cortex. It's the temporal fidelity of the cortex with respect to the thalamic input, it's quite remarkable. So on one side we have this cortex with operates as an amplifier and doesn't seem to add much to what the thalamus tells it to do. And on the other hand, we have this incredible connectivity within the cortex and all those cell types, those various excitatory cell type, inhibitory cell type, very specific connectivity pattern. And the question is, well, do we need all of this just to amplify a signal, essentially? And I hope that this is not the final answer, right? But yet, speaking recently with a few colleagues, the idea came out that even if one wanted just to amplify, to maintain a stability in an amplification, that relies on very sophisticated circuitry. So even just amplifying a signal, right, and maintaining a proper dynamic range and being able not to distort neither spatial information nor temporal information, that might necessitate quite some sophisticated circuitry, right, which is possibly one of the reasons why the cortex is so rich in cell types and and connectivity pattern. So for the moment, I hope we'll find it one day, but we haven't found any property in at least mouse visual cortex, right, which seems really to emerge from a very sophisticated connectivity of mouse visual cortex and not be in one way or another somehow inherited from the connectivity of the thalamus into the cortex. So
I have two kinds of comments to that. And I was wondering, one way to think about it is that, so you start with the kind of basic stimuli to probe what's happening, the responses to contrast and spatial frequency and temporal frequency and gratings and other kinds of things. And maybe the stable of simple stimuli that people have gotten to characterize things that are robust enough for people to use are exactly those things where it's simple enough that the cortex doesn't have to do anything with them, right? And so it's when you get into stimuli that give a variety of responses or inconsistent responses that you can't make sense of and you can't have a hard time comparing across labs and stuff. And that's kind of what the cortex is doing, is the kind of the fancier idiosyncratic stuff.
Yeah, very good point. I think that, there is some hope, right? I agree with that, and we also have in mind a few experiments that we would like to test. So first of all, if we want to discover some stuff that the cortex might be doing and what we're missing, we need to do the experiments inevitably in awake animals, and maybe not even in passive viewing animals, but in actively viewing animals. Maybe present visual scenes that are of some relevance for the animal, relevant maybe either innate relevance or learned relevance, right? So that's the first point. And the second point is maybe those stimuli are not constrained enough in order to trigger what the cortex is there for, if it's there for anything. But we would need more complex statistics, maybe natural statistics, maybe stimuli which are much more complex, within which the animal needs to search and find, some very specific aspect in a natural setting which is going to be relevant for it biologically, essentially. And maybe under those conditions, we would be able to reveal some of the critical properties of the cortex. I absolutely agree.
Because the other kind of flip side on that, which may be a different answer that becomes the same answer. So suppose you do think of the cortex as mostly doing gain control of amplification. Yeah. Well, the question is how sophisticated and how specific your amplifiers could be. So if you want to do something that's specific to complicated stimuli, well, you may want to turn up this feature and that feature there and some kind of crazy combination across the stimulus thing. And then what you are is being selective in the kind of new properties that are a complex pattern of gain modulation, and then the ability to do that flexibly and specifically is kind of where the properties come by.
I agree. This is another view of the cortex, which is essentially we shouldn't look for the cortex as the one that invents new things, but if we look at the output even from a structure as near to the sensory periphery as V1, right? It sends output with different separate channels in many, many brain areas, to other cortical areas, but to plenty of subcortical areas, to the accessory optic system, to various thalamic nuclei, to pontine nuclei, right? All of those outputs, right, must contain information that is relevant to their targets. And so, as you are saying, maybe depending on the conditions, depending on your experience, you want to increase the gain of some output and shut down the gain of other output because at that moment one given stimulus is more relevant than the other, or because based on what you have learned or your attention, one stimulus is more relevant to another. So maybe just looking at the cortex, at least primary visual cortex, because this is what I'm talking about right now, simply as a giant control board, right, is a sophisticated task enough.
Like a guitar amplifier where you have each knob to control bass, middle frequency, high frequency?
Yeah, like many guitars amplifier, like a whole orchestra amplifier, right? Yes.
It seems like what you said about the time constant, though, is really efficient, especially in terms of V1. I mean, the signal's gone after 10 milliseconds, you said. There's no remnant left. Yeah. But presumably that's all the system needs at that sampling level, maybe.
Yeah.
And
the
signal's gone elsewhere. It's no longer, I mean, it's waiting for the next input, right?
So again, if you want, again, a form of disappointment, right? We were hoping to reveal some form of persistent activity in visual cortex once one removes instantaneously its sensory input, right? The idea was, we're going to reveal at least some integrative properties of the cortex. It maintains some visual information for some time, and then, depending on what comes afterwards or so, it's going to be integrated and dispatched to various areas. We haven't seen that because a time constant of 10 milliseconds is essentially the time constant of a neuron, right? It couldn't even be much faster than that if you wanted. So there are two possibilities. Either it is that fast because it's a primary sensory area, and so that's the way it's necessarily so because it needs to be very responsive to time-varying stimuli, and so it has to have a fast time constant. Or it is like this because the animal, despite awake, was not engaged in the stimulus. This was passive viewing. And so maybe things are going to change the day in which we ask the animal to discriminate between stimuli. And then maybe some form of attention would produce some longer integration time in the visual cortex. Or maybe it is that no matter which cortical area you are, a very remote area, you need a loop with the thalamus. And so maybe our corticocentric view, thinking that everything what we observe in the cortex is done in the cortex, is simply wrong. And maybe even the working memories that have been found in prefrontal cortices are not just done by the cortices. They are the cortex in a loop with some subcortical areas, maybe including the thalamus. And so as long as we're searching for things that the cortex by itself is able to do, we're going to be disappointed.
So is it true in the mouse? I know in the cat, it said that 10% of the inputs to V1 are from thalamus.
Yeah.
However, you found that after turning all the intercortical stuff off, that 30% of the excitation was actually coming from thalamus. So that's a relatively small input for what kind of excitation you're seeing. Is that true? I mean, is there any disconnect there with the...
No, I think both are true, but I think both come from different experiments. So the 10% is an anatomical set of data, which is about 10% of the afferents that go into layer 4 in the cat are actually from the thalamus, 10% of the synapses, and all other synapses, 90 or maybe even 95%, come from the cortex. What I have measured, however, is the excitation. And so it is possible that the disconnect is just an apparent disconnect. Maybe even in the mouse, there is only 10% of the synapses that are made by the thalamus and 90% are for the cortex. But maybe the synapses are stronger, and so they provide more excitation. That could be one reason why it ends up with 30% coming from the thalamus in terms of in terms of excitation. And the possibility is that when you give a certain stimulus, maybe you activate all thalamic input, but only a fraction of cortical input, and so maybe you have done this disconnect, right? That when you look at the anatomy, you look at all there is to look at. When you look at excitation, you look only at those neurons that are actually active. So
I have a kind of a strange question about these questions of how much input comes from the thalamus or the cortex always seem kind of strange, because as you presented, it was like, oh, the dominance is from the cortex a lot more, and it's 2-1 or 3-1 or something like that. And I was thinking, like, why does that seem like a lot or a little bit? I mean, where's our expectation come from that it's supposed to be? Is it just supposed to flow through the thalamus that comes through because of our information of sensory processing, and that it just comes through and dominates things, and you can do little tweaks? And then I would say, yeah, you expect, 70-80% coming from the thalamus. But if you think the cortex does everything in the brain and the rest of the stuff is just kind of down there, why would it be dominated by something as lowly as the thalamus? I mean, that seems like maybe a small a small contribution from the cortex. And I just don't know where or what you think about where the expectation would come from about what even how to even make a sense of that number.
Yeah, it's true, right? Why should we be surprised in one way or another if they're not a priori, anyhow, right? That contrasts with that expectation. Well, what can I say about that? I don't know.
Because Hugo and Liesel told us it was like that in the 1960s, and it was convincing, it was compelling. And we still read it. It still influences us. So in the diagram of how a simple cell comes to be a simple cell, a bunch of thalamic cells lined up, and their receptive fields, when superimposed, create the receptive field of the simple cell. That was the model they offered. It was a long time ago, and it was a sophisticated model at the time, even if it doesn't sound very sophisticated now. And the premise of that was that the cortex it's not that it's doing nothing, it's that it's intelligently combining thalamic inputs. And in fact, their whole view, which I think is still basically our view of the visual cortex, is that the connectivity's job is to combine things in clever ways. So that now we take all the things that are red and square and put them together into some little circuit that responds to red square things. The things that are round and red get put into another little circuit for round and red things. So there's almost no room for feedback, right, in that sort of scheme. And so I think the feedback, well, I remember the first time I heard that number 90%, I was shocked. I'm not shocked anymore, but I thought, you know, I think that that's where, and in fact, once you leave that old view, the feed-forward view of the cortex, there's a certain emptiness about how do we interpret the circuitry? How are we going to take what we know about the anatomy and say what the function is going to be? Because in the feed-forward way, you could take the anatomy. You could say, okay, the cell's round and red, and there's another round red cell, and they're going to converge onto some other cell.
So you find your grandmother.
And eventually you find your grandmother.
Jennifer Aniston.
That was, and then you could imagine, I'm going to take the cortical circuitry apart, I'm going to see all of those connections, I'm going to learn the dimensions of the visual world as seen by the V1, what the relevant dimensions are, and it's all going to be done by combinatorics. That's going to do it. But in feedback, the combinatorics kind of fall apart. Because things build on themselves instead of combining with other things. And so I still think it's fascinating and shocking to see that, you know, the cortex is creating so much of that image, even if it's doing it in a very orderly way, without runaway feedback.
Right.
So the feedback that does seem to be there is the same kind that's sort of in my amplifier. In my intracellular recording amplifier, I use positive feedback to get the time constant down, to make things fast, so that action potentials are their real duration and not 10 times longer because of the crazy dynamics of the amplifier. So, if the cortex is going to be able to reproduce visual scenes, we have a flicker fusion frequency at 30 hertz or so, the cortex has got to be able to follow changes in the visual scene up to 30 hertz, or that would match our experience. So that all of that aspect of feedback seems super satisfying to me.
Yep.
But I feel that I've lost the combinatorics. So as we unravel more of the cortical circuitry, are we going to discover the combinatoric aspect of visual processing again? Are we going to recover that in a hierarchy of combinatorics?
I don't know. There are two views, right, in terms of how you get your grandmother. One is the original view, in which you go from primary to secondary sensory areas, and you move up the hierarchy, and you create those combinations, and eventually all those little features together give rise to your grandmother. And and there are evidences for grandmothers in the cortex, right? You put... there are face cells. You in that experiment from Koch a few years ago, there was an electrode implanted in the cortex of some patient, and those cells would respond only for Holly Berry, either as a face and written, and not for any combination. So that was not his grandmother, by the way, but it could have been, right?
Or he wanted his grandmother to be.
And so that's so there are evidence for grandmother self. What I'm saying is not there is this evidence. On the other hand, however, the point is how do we get there, right? And do we get there really from by moving from one cortical area to the next according to one anatomical hierarchy? Or do we get there by bouncing information back and forth from the cortex to the thalamus, back to the cortex and to the thalamus, via the pulvina, for example, for the visual system? And Marie Sharman, for example, has been a promoter of the idea that actually the main driver lines are not from one cortical area to the next, but it has to bounce back to the thalamus and then back. Which would bring the thalamus much more into the loop of actually sensory processing and transformation of information from one area to the next, as compared to simply once it gets to the cortex, then it stays there and it remains there until you discover your grandmother somewhere. So I don't know. Right now I'm not even sure what type of experiment to do. Right, to know. Where to look at where transformation changes, right? For the moment, in fact, it's a little bit magic, right? I don't doubt the fact that there are Holly Berry neurons, and it's obvious that even in monkey, you have those super specialized cells like face recognition cell, like mirror neurons, etc., etc. But it is absolutely not clear how you go from an orientation-tuned cell to a cell that recognizes a face, right? And if we want to figure it out, we need to begin knowing what pathway it takes, at least from the orientation-tuned cell to the face cell. We need to know whether that whole thing stays in the cortex and doesn't need to go down to the thalamus anymore, or whether a transformation, if it's a transformation as we imagine it, occurs just by bouncing back information from V1 to the thalamus, back to V2, from V2 back to the thalamus, and then to higher cortical areas and so on. And I think that's a first important question, because when we figure out how information gets transmitted from lower to higher area, then maybe we can follow how slowly an orientation-tuned cell transforms the information taken from orientation-tuned cell gets into a face or into a mirror neuron or as far as I'm concerned, to a place cell or a grid cell.
But it does sound like the kind of experiment that you might do.
We're thinking about it.
Because what your techniques are great at are now isolating projections that used to always be stimulated together.
Yeah.
And so I guess if you go to a higher order visual area and look at the visual cortex input to that.
Yes, this is what we're starting to do. Absolutely. Yes.
Looking forward to hearing that.
But Massimo, if you think about the efficiency of the system, this is going to be a lot of cost of energy if always the information is into the cortex, to the thalamus, back to the cortex, down, back again.
Do you have to pay by the millimeter? Is that
not pay by the millimeter? I think all these people, they study entropy. It seems that right now the entropy of this system is maximized. Correct. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. This is what I was.
It is closer.
Okay.
Then I go down to the thalamus. I was just wondering how the brain calculates the cost of things.
Of this distance.
Well, actually, it's true that axonal length has been often invoked as something that needs to be minimized.
Yes.
And if information keeps on going back and forth, then that's a bad way to minimize it. I never thought about it. That's a good point. It's a good point. Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, one cannot forget, when we think about a thalamic input, the first thing that comes into mind is obviously the input from a primary sensory nucleus to the cortex, and then we think about the rest of the cortex as being thalamic independent, and that's simply anatomically wrong, right? Every part of the cortex receives receives thalamic inputs from secondary nuclei, and those secondary nuclei get their information from primary cortical areas. So clearly the route, right, to go back and forth, like Guillory and Sherman suggest, exists, and they have also good physiological evidence for this to be actually a major route. They make the distinction between drivers and modulators. I don't know if you remember. And I think it's a hypothesis that needs to be taken into consideration very, very much so, actually.
So in thinking about drivers and modulators, I'm reminded that your data suggested that the primary effect of the corticothalamic pathway was on nucleus reticularis.
Yes.
And that the huge projection to the lateral geniculate, its effect was hard to detect in comparison to the inhibitory input.
Yeah, that's true. So that's layer 6, though, right? Layer 6.
So, but what about that? I mean, the layer 6 projects to the relay nuclei in a huge way.
Yeah.
And according to Murray Sherman, this should be a modulatory input that acts through G protein-coupled receptors or something like that. But is it hard to see any effect of it at all?
Okay, so it is hard to see any effect given the experiment that we did. Our experiment was to activate layer 6 corticothalamic neurons, and what we observed is a strong suppression of LGN. That's very clear. Now, we have also data that suggests that the strong suppression comes from the nucleus reticularis, this massive inhibitory nucleus that projects to the LGN, and we know that layer 6 corticothalamic neuron sends a branch to the nucleus reticularis thalamus. So it makes both physiological and anatomical sense. Now, this said, I could my opinion is that layer 6 corticothalamic neuron have a nest suppressive effect on the LGN. So it's a negative feedback. Okay, this I stand to that. But this doesn't mean that this suppression doesn't have a special profile onto the LGN. There might be neurons that are more suppressed than others if there was a special profile, because there is a retinotopy from layer 6 down to the thalamus. And so it could be possible that a pathway that goes from the retina to the LGN to a group of neurons in the cortex that is particularly activated, maybe it's suppressed a little bit less than the surround, giving rise to a form of overall suppression, but with a stronger surround suppression, right? So there might be a special structure to that suppression.
So if we took out the nucleus reticularis altogether and just looked at layer 6 projections of the thalamus, we might see CLC suppression, you think? Do you think that the glutamate effects in the relay nuclei might be net inhibitory also?
It could also be net inhibitory, but through the local inhibitory neuron. So one of the few nuclei in the thalamus that contain primary sensory nuclei that contain inhibitory neuron is also the LGN. And so it's possible that glutamate release from layer 6 cells onto the thalamus, onto the LGN, activates those inhibitory neurons, which then would also suppress through their GABA. But I don't know that. I haven't done the experiment.
Can I ask another technical question? I know you guys want to talk about it.
No, we won't have time for interneurons. So. Go ahead.
We won't have time
for
interneurons.
We
got to
have time for
interneurons.
We'll make time. Okay.
So here's my other technical question. It has to do with the orientation selectivity story.
Yes.
So the orientation selectivity arises in the cortical neurons that you studied because of an offset in the two center responses
to on and off inputs.
And so that the surround doesn't actually appear. So the thalamic neurons should have an inhibitory surround, and the old story about orientation selectivity in simple cells relied on the inhibitory surround in a way. Your explanation doesn't rely on any inhibitory surround.
No, because the fact that it doesn't appear is because we couldn't measure it.
Uh-huh.
So it might well be that if our measurements of receptive field structures had been more sophisticated, more sensitive, we could have seen not only the center, but also the surround. And we haven't seen the surround. So
the surround would appear as a facilitation, as a removal of excitation.
Yes, as a removal.
So to see that, you need to have sort of cranked up excitation.
You need to have some baseline activity, yeah. Essentially. We would see this as a reduction. But we had some thalamic baseline activity. So what I believe is if we had sampled 10 times more data, we could have maybe seen some...
But your mechanism doesn't actually require it.
But the mechanism per se, the mechanism per se, in order to account for the orientation tuning that we see, doesn't necessitate. It just necessitates a separation of the on center and the off center. Yeah. Right. That's all we need.
So are those simple cells?
Those are simple cells. Yeah. Those are simple cells. Almost all cells in layer 4 in the mouse have
have
simple cell properties. Yes. Yeah. If you look at their spiking, and you know, they're very well F1 modulated.
Okay, I'm done with that.
Can I move over to inner neurons then?
Yeah.
Mind. So some of your recent data have shown that the gene expression pattern is a strong predictor of connectivity between interneurons in the visual cortex. And this kind of validates this molecular marker categorization approach over, I guess, older, but more traditional methods of electrophysiological or subjective morphological characterization. So given our more refined categorization approaches that are kind of happening now, how close are we to having a causal link between, you know, molecular expression patterns and the various functional and morphological properties of a given neuron category? I mean, and how important do you think that is? Just say something about this for us.
So I think we're still very far from causal. But I believe that genetic expression patterns are going to be the way by which we're going to finally find a consensus in terms of cell types, both excitatory and inhibitory in the cortex. And the consensus because it's going to be essentially an objective measure, in my opinion. So the next step is... to start doing the entire transcriptome, not just fishing for a few genes like we did in the past, just we fish for 20 or 30 genes and then we presented the one that correlated best with some functional property and network property, but it's to look for the entire transcriptome and start making correlation with the transcriptome of an individual neuron and whatever property is of interest for you of that neuron. In what layer it is, where it projects, what input it gets from, and ideally its tuning property. Is it tuned, whether it's tuned to vertical bars or horizontal bars, whether it's the spatial frequency tuning is so much or so much, and find the genes that correlates the best, that predicts the gene or set of genes that predict the tuning properties the best. That would give us to begin with, a sort of objective handle on those neurons. We don't no longer need to dispute as whether this is really a basket cell or not a basket cell because you drew it this way, I drew it this way. Does it express this set of genes or not? And we know it. And if we can correlate gene expression with all other features of neurons that we are interested in, projections, anatomical, functional, for example, when we look at them in vivo, that would be fantastic because simply by looking at the gene expression pattern by using some in situ hybridizations or so, we would be able to identify the functional properties of entire cortical maps and connectivity property, which I would find spectacular. And not only, even if we had those correlates, strong correlates, we could start, would then have a hook to the perturbation of those neurons, right? One person today during the seminar suggested, what if you were to remove all the neurons that are tuned to a given orientation? Well, if I knew that there is a specific molecular marker, even if it's just correlative, in any neuron that have that orientation, now I could get into them and kill them, right? And that would be great from a basic science point of view, because perturbing a specific function in the cortex would elucidate about the role of that function, right? But it would be very, very cool also in the clinic, right? If I know that a brain is dysfunctional because that particular function is overrepresented, for example, then I tune it down by targeting those neurons molecularly. So I think that finding even just correlative maps between correlations between gene expression and whatever property you want of a neuron is going to be of immense use, immense.
One question about that whole proposal in terms of, it's interesting about how far it goes, right? So the question then becomes, if the correlation at that level, at the very specific level, is really strong, then you have to question, what is brain plasticity? That would mean that if you change any of those things, then you're going to have to change all those molecular gene expression kind of patterns to do that. So that means that you're limited, well, I don't know whether you're limited or not, but any kind of brain plasticity that you imagine would then really have to fundamentally change a lot of stuff about
the cell.
That'd be great,
because then you'd see the transcription change that accompanies that plasticity. You could use that as a marker for the plasticity. I don't think there's any reason to think that transcription is more stable than everything else. Right.
I know. It's I agree with that. It's strange, right? When we think about finding a correlation between some aspect of a neuron, might be a morphological aspect or functional aspect, and the transcript seems possible as long as one thinks, well, but then how could things be plastic? But as you are saying, I think things could perfectly be plastic and the transcript don't be plastic, right? And there might be some aspect of a neuron that are not that plastic. For example, if I'm a layer 6 corticothalamic neuron and I have a gene that correlates with me being not only layer 6 but also be corticothalamic, that might not necessarily be very subject to plasticity. I don't think that projection is not plastic. But maybe if I'm a layer 6 corticothalamic neurons that make strong synapses onto the thalamus or make weak synapses might also be correlated with another gene, and that aspect might be actually plastic. So yes, I think that that's a whole trove to discover. I think that there's going to be amazing discoveries in there in finding just correlations between gene expressions and function. And the reason is that doing experiments that allow us to do the two, do deep sequencing, right? And at the same time, do the sequencing from the material that you get from one single neuron. And knowing everything you want to know about that single neuron is becoming more and more feasible, right? You can look at a neuron in vivo by looking at its calcium transient under a 2-photon microscope. Then you can label that particular neuron by photoactivatable GFP. Then you can cut slices from that brain that you image in vivo, and then you can sample the DNA from that neuron for which you know the function described in vivo. Then you can suck up all the RNA, do deep sequencing, and right now it's kind of cost prohibitive because that would cost many tens of dollars a neuron. If you want to do thousands of neurons, that would become difficult. But as you know, we've seen the costs of full transcript analysis go down by orders of magnitude. So maybe it's going to cost 50 cents a cell in a few years, and then we can do it for 1,000 cells for the 350,000 cells of visual cortex in the mouse.
I think you just proposed a giant grant for the Brain Initiative. Yeah, exactly. There we go. Done.
Let's do that.
Well, thank you. This has been great. Thanks for visiting with us, Massimo Scanciani. This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop. Mm-hmm.